you.
Hi, so I'm Ray, and welcome to Sys Trace for Slackers. So, what is Sys Trace? Why is Sys Trace? So Sys Trace is basically, it records a program's behavior into a policy file, and it records what it does normally, and then when you run it again, it confines it to that policy and prevents it from doing anything that's out of the ordinary. Anytime it does anything that deviates from this standard behavior, automatically gets blocked and logged. So if, for example, your web browser suddenly started going on IRC channels and stuff, you would want to know that unless you're using Mozilla or something. It helps you protect your programs from being exploited. If it ever does get exploited and tries to get a user shell, it's completely blocked. So Sys Trace can protect many programs, like such as chat clients. Chat clients are connected to the network all the time, listen to a lot of traffic. Not all of it is good, some of it is malicious. And there have been cases where chat clients get exploited and then the remote user gets a shell. Am I blocking you guys? And, that's how monkey.org got hacked. On the other hand, web servers are constantly listening to traffic, and we all know how often web servers get hacked, especially Microsoft ones. But this is not for Microsoft, so too bad. Web servers should only be listening to the network. They should not be making any network connections, generally. They should also not be executing any programs. So that's a expected behavior that can be recorded and confined to. Commercial software often just comes in a binary executable. You don't have a source to it. You don't know what it actually does. For example, lots of spyware nowadays is very popular. They always install weird things all over the place. Say the Opera browser. It's a web browser, but you don't have the source to it, and you want to run it. So you can run Sys Trace on it, see what it does, and then just sort of keep it doing that one thing, surfing websites, not deleting files en masse. Sys Trace uses policies to confine programs. Policies are just plain text files. They're pretty simple to understand once you know what you're doing. It's not that difficult to understand. It consists of line after line of what it allows the program to do. And anything that's not in the policy file is automatically blocked and logged. So it goes according to system calls, which are a low-level way of communicating with the kernel in Unix. But there are a lot of system calls, but you don't really actually need to know all of them. Most important ones are execv, which is used to execute programs. So you don't want most programs don't really run too many other programs, except for like the user shell. Chat programs, they don't really run programs. They just do their own thing. Connect is used to connect to the internet, make network connections. Text editors should not be making network connections, for instance. Bind is used to listen for network connections. Most user software should not be listening to them. Only servers, web servers, network servers, they should be listening to them. FSWrite, FSRead, those are actually fake system calls. It's used to group together all the file system writes and reads into those two. Everything else pretty much is necessary for normal operation. A bunch of them like mmap and stuff, exit. You need them in order to run the program normally. And you don't really have much of a choice in terms of the parameters. So you can pretty much ignore them. If it registers that the program needs it, then just permit it. So I'll go through a bunch of these, the specific ones, the ones that you can tune, the ones I just went over, and I'll explain how to use them. So a typical shell has access to, read access to the entire file system, except, you know, they have file system access controls, like permissions and stuff. So we'll just leave it at that, just let it read all files and let the file system manage the permissions. But for writing, generally you can sum it up as you can write it in your own home, you can write it in the temp directory, and that's it. You generally can't write in any other directory. This is just a sample policy. And so with these two rules may appear in a system shell, for example. But some people want to have it more restricted. Some people want it so that you can't really read all files. For instance, some people don't. Some systems are set up so that you're not allowed to read other users' directories. So we can set it up like this, where first, if it's matching your own home, then it's automatically allowed. So, and then if it doesn't match your own home, then it matches the home directory. Then it automatically is denied with a permission error, and that generally covers every file that you're not supposed to access. And then after that, everything outside of that just permit as usual. So in systrace rules, the order is the first match. Well, that's a match. The first match wins. So if it matches this first, then it automatically passes. If it then matches this, then it's denied in this case, and then here it matches everything else, and it gets permitted. So program execution. These rules allow you to have a program run other programs, and this allows them to run all the system binaries, basically. Everything in bin, sbin, user bin, games, of course, user sbin. The way this works is every time a program tries to run another program, systrace covers that as well. So it automatically uses that next process's policy file and covers according to that. So there's no way to really, you can't just like run another file and escape systrace unless explicitly listed in the systrace policy. But this could be a hassle because that means that every single one of these programs, you need to write a systrace policy. And I say it's easy to write it, but you know, there are a lot of programs, so there are shortcuts. You can share the policy file using the inherit quality of permit. So what this does is every time it executes a program, it allows it. But then that same policy file is used to govern the program that's run. So you only need one policy file, and you can sort of generalize that, oh yes, every program that the user shell runs can write into your own home directory and the temp directory, and that's it. And this will allow you to use that throughout for every program that's executed. So let's go on to network connections. Game, for instance, a typical usage of game is to connect on AOL Instant Messenger. So in this example, we allow it to connect to any internet address port 5190 to go on AIM, and it also allows it to do DNS lookups on the local host. Anything else is not allowed. For web browsers, it's a little bit more complicated because you serve so many IP, so many sites and there are so many IPs and stuff. In this case, you allow port 80 for HTTP traffic, HTTPS traffic for 443, DNS lookups, and in case you ever go to any sites that, say, require connecting to a port 8080 or something, then this rule will ask the user if you really want to do that. So this way, you can connect to any site you want at any port you want, but if it's not a port 80 or port 443, then it will ask you to make sure that you really are trying to do that instead of, you know, running some sort of script or whatever. Web servers. Web servers listen to port 80, and in this rule, it allows it to listen to port 80, matching every interface on the system.
I'm going a little too fast. Okay.
That's a good command, isn't it? The first command? Very helpful, isn't it?
Yeah. So, typically when I sys-trace a program, I run it through sys-trace minus capital A, I, and then Firefox. I'm using Firefox because somebody said that it's impossible to sys-trace Firefox on OpenBSD mailing list, so I'm just here to sort of show you how it's done. So what this does is the capital A flag, it automatically logs every single system call that's made and every parameter, and automatically generates this policy. So for every file that you access, every website that you go to, it automatically logs it down. And it makes it, it basically writes it for you, writes the policy for you. Then, you know, you surf the web a bit, you go to different sites, you go to different sites with different ports, or go to sites with a Java plugin, whatever. Do everything that you would normally do, and you quit Firefox. And it, after that, you have the sys-trace policy that's probably huge because of all the IPs that you're connecting to, all the website, all the cache files that are saved onto the hard drive. And you clean it up a little bit, and you and then it can be trimmed down. I wish I had a better example, I guess. Right, policy management. Normally, after doing that, the first thing I do is sort the policy. I usually sort the policy by their system call, and so you have different system calls, and when you do sys-trace minus capital A, it automatically does, it adds the lines as they are being called. It doesn't sort them at all. And you get, when you wind up like with a 5 meg file or something, and it looks unmanageable. You can't just go through every single one and parse it down or whatever, simplify them. So sorting them helps a lot. Sorting them helps a lot. Actually shows here. I forgot to mention the minus I flag. That automatically inherits all the things, so you only generate one policy. So, for instance, Firefox is a tough beast because it's actually a shell script that calls another executable that possibly calls another executable, and it just makes it easier to just put it all under one policy file, because then you don't need to manage three policy files and figure out what's what. This automatically adds the inherit stuff into the policy file. But afterwards, you still need to change the rules so that when it does the permit, it doesn't have the inherit keyword, so you still need to add it back, unless you plan on running it with the minus I flag all the time. Libraries have some IPs. Usually what they do is, for every library, every path, and every IP, it automatically gets put into the policy file. You can reduce these a lot, like in the previous examples, by using matching it with the asterisk and stuff. So you can just put down like a short path, like the home directory that I did earlier. Library files, generally, it doesn't really matter if every program is able to read your libraries, so you should just enable them all, because it's not like you're executing anything. The execve flag system call is pretty important. That's the one that you should really be looking out for. Make sure that the programs that it's executing is really allowed. Version control. This helps a lot. After you save a file, it helps to use version control on the file to because sometimes you miss a system call or something and you want to enable it. So you start adding these rules and you sort of lose track of them. Using version control helps a lot to keep things in order, to know which one was generated and which one wasn't. There's actually a interactive tool that you can use as well, instead of just using automatic policy generation mode. There's a graphical utility that you can use to allow or deny rules as they come, as they're being executed. And I don't use that very much when you first run a program, because a program makes a lot of system calls, so you just wind up hitting enter a lot just to permit every single one. But after a while, when you have like a program that's running normally, you can use that instead of blocking all things, instead of blocking all rules. And yeah. Well, alternatives. If you want to confine it in other ways, you can use physical separation. Put each service into a different computer. That way, if somebody ever takes it over, what they're left with is just that dedicated computer, and it won't trash anything else. You can use jail, which is available for FreeBSD. Jail, you run another instance of the operating system that's more confined on the existing system. You can run multiple ones. You can talk to Ike about that. He'll tell you about it. You can run system emulators, such as Xen or VMware, and that emulates the entire machine architecture. So all processes that are run are confined to that one process. So if anything goes wrong, it just takes down that one process. You can talk to Johnny Lam about that. You can use privilege separation, which is a method a lot of OpenBSD developers like to use. It requires modifying the program source itself, and it changes it so that if it's run as root, it will try to lock itself up into an empty directory and then drop all privileges. So that way, it can't, even if it ever gets broken into, it's stuck in an empty directory with no privileges, no write privileges, read privileges, nothing. And the closest thing that I can think of that I could find to systrace for FreeBSD is this kernel module called serb. It hasn't been maintained since 2003, but then again, systrace hasn't really been updated that much either. It's a kernel module. The policy file seems much more complex. I haven't really used it, but although it's more complex, it's also more powerful, it seems. Much more conditionals and stuff. But when you're managing a lot of processes, it gets unwieldy to have to create such complex policies for every single program. It's complex enough using SysTrace, actually, when you have a massive amount of programs to SysTrace. SysTrace has some advantages over a lot of these. Well, physical separation, first of all, costs money. That's a big issue. With physical separation, jail, and system emulators, typically you need to have multiple copies of the operating system. SysTrace only requires a policy file. You don't need to modify the environment, you don't need to modify the executable, nothing. There's no file copying, and you can share the SysTrace policy file with your friends, whatever. It's,
Or among servers.
Yeah. Your friends, the servers.
Are your friends and servers, both.
So there's the overhead of maintenance, because there are multiple copies of an operating system running around. There's also, with system emulation, you also have the overhead of emulating a machine architecture. So that slows things down immensely. Well, I haven't measured it, but it does. There is the overhead.
What's the overhead with SysTrace?
SysTrace, it's there was a paper on this done by Niels Provost and Doug Song. They SysTrace the entire monkey.org server. And they have over 200 users, and I don't know, they have over 200 users, and every single process is SysTraced. Overhead, I believe, it depends on a system call. It depends on a program, rather. Something like CVS accesses a file system a lot. So it calls the system call a lot, the FS read system call a lot. So that slows it down. I think it had a 20% slowdown. But most other programs, ones that don't like crawl the file system, are generally fine. They only introduce like maybe 0.5%. I'm just grabbing numbers out, but it's approximately that. Overhead is not that bad. I use it to run process SysTrace every single process on my laptop, and I don't find it slow at all. Running computationally expensive stuff doesn't hurt at all, like M player or whatever, video players. The problem with privilege separation is, as I said, you need to modify the source. So unless the source is yours, it's going to be hard to maintain if you're taking code from a third party and you modify it yourself. It also requires a deeper understanding of the source code that not many people have the knowledge nor the time to obtain. But otherwise, actually, privilege separation is pretty good, because all these things actually work pretty well in conjunction with SysTrace, because you don't actually, they're not exclusive. So I use privilege separation with SysTrace on a lot of server daemons, because once they change users, they drop privileges, it's easy to identify which user does what. So in SysTrace, you can specify that only the root user can bind to port 80. And then once it drops privileges to the www user, it can no longer bind to port 80, even if it wanted to. And other stuff. Like, it makes it easier to actually separate the policies into generate like two policies almost, the privileged user and the unprivileged user. SERP, I don't really use it too much, so I can't really say. The syntax seems more difficult than more complicated than SysTrace, as I said, but at the same time, it does seem more powerful. It also needs to be a kernel module. SysTrace comes out of the box with OpenBSD, NetBSD. There's a port for it for Linux, and there are outdated ports for FreeBSD and Mac OS X.
So, in conclusion, SysTrace can prevent exploits, prevent a program that's suffering from, say, a buffer overflow or something from obtaining a shell. You can use it to run unknown programs safely because you can deny it if it ever tries to delete any files when it's not supposed to be a file deletion program. You can use it to minimize privileges I haven't talked about that. You can minimize privileges because there is a feature of SysTrace called privilege escalation, elevation. What it does is you can run a program as, say, user www, and then when it tries to bind to port 80, it will execute that one system call as root. Everything else will be run as user www. So all those, like, it reduces the window of opportunity for an attacker immensely. Policies are relatively easy to understand if you know how to read them. And, well, rather, if you get used to it, actually. Once you get used to it, it's pretty easy. There is an initial learning curve, though. Usually people generate a policy, say, for Firefox, because that's the most obvious target. And they see a 5-meg file, and they don't know what to do with it. Hopefully I've explained some methods of trimming it down by sorting it and by combining some of the rules together using matching rules. You can trim down the file immensely. Unfortunately, because of the initial learning curve, it is underused and misunderstood. People think it's too hard, and so they don't use it too much. So,
besides the security, it sounds like it does a log of system calls. Is there any reason to use ptrace or trust, or as opposed to just using this?
You can combine them together. I mean, there's nothing really stopping you from combining them.
Does it pretty much replace that?
You can't really say that it replaces it because they do different things. This combines programs according to a system call, and actually, I'm not sure what trust is.
It's just a layer of privilege.
Well, things like ptrace would give you the return value of the system call and things like that.
Yeah,
you get that out of SysTrace.
It just says what the system call is called.
Yeah. So those are mainly to list out what system calls were made. It really doesn't do much for security to know what the program did, except for logging purposes, possibly. So they're really totally different beasts. Policy generation can be tedious if you're SysTracing a lot of programs. It was tedious when I first did try to SysTrace every single process on my laptop, but after a while, it's just I ran out of new programs to run, so I had policies for every single program I ran. Unfortunately, those policies are a bit specialized, and there are a lot of files, so the repositories that people put up sometimes, like Harry Eyeball had a SysTrace repository, they weren't very clean, and I was hoping to maybe work with Okan and George to set up a SysTrace repository of known clean SysTrace policies so that people can build upon it and improve upon them, reduce the problem of the policy generation.
They announced it in 2002.
What?
Harry Eyeball.
Yeah.
So it looks dated.
It is really dated. And it has all sorts of problems, like it uses the user's full path name. So unless you happen to use a username of Flow, you can't really use their policy.
Can you manually edit the text, though?
Yeah, but you'd have to manually edit the text. A better designed one would be to use the home variable.
Yeah. Use the variables instead of absolutes. Yeah. But I mean, that's not like the end of the world. I mean, it's a text file. You just edit the text file, and it's
time. I mean, source code is just a text file.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's not currently in active development. Niels Provost, the main developer, he basically hasn't been developing it much, unfortunately. I'm not sure why. I guess he's just busy. But
what does it lack?
That's what I'm saying. It's already pretty powerful. So I'm not really sure what to add to it. I mean, what we could do is we could make like better interfaces, maybe. Better interfaces making it easier for mass policy generation that are safe and secure. It isn't. Like, I'm not really sure what sort of improvements can be put into SysTrace. Too many people. What?
I think the one thing that would be helpful is if SysTrace actually did an optimization of the or generalization of the policies themselves. Because you look at these, you know, the ones that come with the automatically generated policy rules. You say, you know, like you said, if you're using it on a web browser, you have, you know, 100 or so, you know, IPs, and then you just,
yeah,
it'd be nice if you generalize, just put a star, you know, everything.
Well, the GUI.
You have to do by hand, but it'd be interesting to see, you know, there's not good generalization.
This can be done with the GUI, though. The GUI does have, it's kind of rudimentary, but it does have some shortcuts that you can use. So whenever a system call is made, the GUI comes up, and then you can use the drop-down box to either permit this system call explicitly, or permit the system call as it was called, including the IP and port and all that, or it can do some grouping for you. This can be improved upon. I don't think the GUI is very good. I wish I had a screenshot of the GUI, though. What's up?
Is this for server exploit?
Yes. It has had an exploit in NetBSD. Not in OpenBSD. It was for a short period of time before, I think, the NetBSD 2.0 was released. It was, if you ran SysTrace as root, some malicious program could exploit the privilege elevation feature and make themselves root or something like that. But that has been fixed, and there hasn't been an exploit since 2004, I think. But then there hasn't been much development, I don't know.
What do you see when you're running your laptop and one of the SysTrace rules is broken?
It depends on how you run it. If you're running it in automatic policy enforcement, it just blocks it and logs it to the system log.
You don't notice it.
But it depends on how you run it. You can also run it interactively with the GUI. If a system call is blocked, then the GUI pops up and tells you that your web browser is trying to delete some file or whatever. It tells you the system call, it tells you the parameters that were given to it, and then you can either permit it and turn it into a new addition to the policy file. Or you can deny it, or you can kill the program, or whatever.
Can you test your running process? Can you test your running process?
Can I test it right now?
No, can you test your running process?
I don't do it, but I think you can. It uses the same facilities as GDB, I believe, so just like GDB can attach to a running process, you can do that. You can't, unfortunately, because of the way it is, you can't run GDB and SysTrace at the same time, so it's kind of quirky like that. But Yeah, just like GDB, you can attach it to, you should be able to attach it to a running process. I've never done it, so I'm not going to say. Okan is nodding his head, so you can hammer him if, you know, it turns out to be false. Yes?
So, let's say I have a binary application.
Mm-hmm.
I have other users on the system that run. So I spend one day to profile the application and build policies for it.
Mm-hmm.
So is it possible to have it so every time any user runs that application, it runs with the SysTrace policies that it created, or do you actually have to explicitly say, you know, run this with this policy and run this application?
You'll have to set it up so that whenever a user runs it, it's that process is SysTrace. There is a SysTrace shell written by Doug Sung and then rewritten by Jose Nazario. Over here. You can get that. What it is it's a shell that automatically calls the user's shell SysTrace. So it will, if you put a system policy into the system directory, then it will automatically cover any program that's executed with that the SysTrace policy. Yes. It's possible, but then there are some issues with that because of all the changing users and stuff. There are some issues. I've tried to do something similar to that, actually. I tried to SysTrace Getty, the terminal console. It was kind of messy. Like, there are some flaws in SysTrace and the way it handles users and stuff. It's a bit quirky.
It's kind of like storing jails in an RC system, too.
But usually it's best to run separate SysTrace policies, I mean, SysTrace processes from each user's shell or something. For instance, I SysTrace the X terminal. I don't SysTrace my window manager, because if the window manager ever does anything, it just freezes the whole window manager and the GUI can't even pop up. So it's kind of, it depends. Like, there's a certain level you need to do with it. SysTracing it at the shell is a good idea, because if there is ever a policy violation, you need to restart the SysTrace policy to reload processes, policies. So you don't want to have to reboot the machine every time you add a new policy, you know. So with the SysTrace shell, what you can do is you can just kill the process, like log out, log in again, and then you'll reload a modified policy if it already hasn't loaded. Because it gets each process that runs a program automatically loads the policy file into a kernel, and it keeps it in memory. So you can't just get around a policy by editing the policy file. Yes.
You said SysTrace in the shell. What happens if you do an exec of the same shell again? Does it reload the policies? Or?
No. Well, you'd need it would. When you execute SysTrace on SysTrace, it depends on how you set up. You need to set up a policy for SysTrace in order to run SysTrace on itself. It just depends on the flow of the program. You need to provide a policy for every program that executes, because every program that is executed, it automatically gets covered by the SysTrace program. So you need a policy for that. And if you wanted to loop back like that, you'll just need a policy that permits itself to run itself.
Would that reload, like modify those policies?
It would start two SysTrace policies, one under another. The second one would have a reloaded policy. The first one won't. So
when you exec the process, it replaces the parent process, right? So what happens then?
It replaces the parent process, but it's still covered by the systrace the original systrace process.
Okay.
So it follows that it just tracks it. So you can't really escape it unless it explicitly says so in the policy. There's actually, in addition to inherit, there's also a detach exec you can use. You can do that for, say, the SSH daemon. What it does is, when a user logs in, the SSH daemon is systrace. And then when a user logs in, as it's executing the shell, it detaches the shell. So, and then the shell itself executes systrace to run the shell. So then it starts up a new systrace policy process. So that makes it so that if there are any modifications to the shell, to any program in the shell, all you need to do is log back in, and it doesn't follow the SSH daemon's policy, which could be kind of old, I guess, by the time it runs.
I'm thinking of practical implications of, first thing, the hairy eyeball is gone. There's nothing there.
Okay.
I'll try to Google and see if there's a cache of it, but it doesn't look like there's anything there, so that's something we should definitely discuss. But what about in terms of system? I mean, you're talking about, you know, end-user kind of workstation processes and things. What about in the sense of in the context of a server? Like, you have, like, you know, X amount of, you know, daemons running. Have you worked in that scenario with systrace? And how is that part of the 160 rules, rule sets that Harry Arbol had? I mean,
daemons are actually, I find them a bit easier to systrace because they don't do so many things.
Exactly, they're limited.
They're actually easier to systrace because they only bind to port 80 or they make connection MTP requests to port 123. They only read from, like, say, the web directory, any file from inside there. They never do anything else. Whereas users, they program, they run other executables, they check their mail, and it gets much more difficult, actually, with user shells.
But I think, the majority of this, I'm definitely more concerned with what's happening on a server than I am with on a desktop, right? Because there's a lot more users interacting with the server, and it's a public IP that's sitting on the internet, right?
Yeah.
So I'm just curious about that. But the other thing is that, in that case, can you think of a scenario where you're, like, you have a whole bunch of boxes and you're trying to enforce systrace policies throughout them. I mean, would you all be rsyncing in a centralized manner out to all your servers? I mean, how would you do that? Would you just have individual systrace policies?
Well, I would try to make a systrace policy that covers them all and then have a master repository and put updates there. What you do is you monitor the syslog, the system log, and see if there are any systrace violations, and then you see if it's legal or not. If it suddenly tried to read a file that you forgot about, then you add that to the systrace policy, modify it, and then restart the processes so that it is updated with the new systrace policy. I did that with the Tor daemon. I just ran the Tor daemon for like a couple of hours on automatic policy generation mode. And then after that, I took the policy, cleaned it up a bit, and then I let it run in automatic policy enforcement mode, which is lowercase a flag. So that makes it so that all attempts to call invalid systrace system calls are automatically blocked and logged. And then every so often I would just check the system log to see if there are any new violations. And it's been running fine for like weeks, and it's only like a 20 or 30 line systrace policy. Most of them are just like MMAP, permit, mprotect, permit. It's just, very simple. And this can be reused, too. If you generalize it enough, you can be reused. You can specify for it to bind to any IP, port 80, and it can be used in any server. Or you can, if you want, you can also specify that it only binds to a certain port. I mean, a certain host name, a certain IP. And that will prevent it from, say, getting a new IP, aliasing it, and binding to it. It's pretty flexible. And the thing is, these are all permit rules, mostly. So if you see a violation, you can just add it. And if you go a little crazy and add too many rules, at the very least, it's still a small subset of the system calls that you normally are allowed to run. So you're still better off. And you're still more protected. The only thing that you need to watch, again, is the executions. Most programs, especially servers, don't execute any programs. So you should really watch out for those. Those you should scrutinize. But file names, it doesn't really matter. Like if user shells can read the whole file system, because there are file system permissions in check anyway. And like I said, users, they do all sorts of crazy stuff. So it's kind of hard to narrow it down to one policy. Yes?
You went over a lot of the basic system calls, and you went over some of the behaviors to look for and mm-hmm. filter out with. If you're not familiar in C, what other areas do you need to read up on or to be aware of?
You
need to know more about system calls, about libraries?
Well, if you want to find out more about the system calls, you can just look it up in the man page. There are manuals for all the system calls, and you can tell if this one is used to allocate memory or if this one is used to check what ID it's running as. Most of these are pretty innocuous. So when you see it, when you use automatic policy generation, it generates you can just pretty much just accept them, and you don't really need to remove any system calls that it makes. Again, it's just the 8 system calls I mentioned that I usually deal with. Everything else, it doesn't really matter that much.
I kind of 2 questions.
Mm-hmm.
I hear a lot about from the user perspective. You already asked about the servers. Is this a panacea? Should we be doing this everywhere? And the follow-up question would be,
what is it a panacea for?
Well, you know, is this the security for the threat model that he's talking about? The other half of the question is, have you seen any obvious exploits that the system has stopped?
Well, there was a NetBSC exploit a couple years back.
I had someone trying to use your system or someone taking over your system that SysTrace stopped. The threat model, have you seen it in action?
That would be a negatory.
So you've got this running and it's never actually done anything for you.
No, but I have seen some interesting behavior from different programs. For instance, Conqueror and Firefox, sometimes they try to write into the system the system folders. Like it tries to, for some odd reason, it's trying to write into /user/local/bin/firefox. I don't know why it's writing to its own binary, but it does. I haven't really looked into it or anything. Like, the bigger the program, a lot of times, they just do weird things, and it's just, I guess it's better just to have it running to protect it in case it does. Does that answer your question?
So put it everywhere, but
I think it gives you insight into what the programs do. If you look at some of the stuff, like you were saying, Firefox or something, or Game, or any one of these applications you implicitly trust to run on your laptop or wherever it is, if you start looking through policies, like, why is it trying to write to my root partition? Okay, you have file system protection behind that, but why is it trying to read my password file? Why? You know, the secure password file, as opposed to, you know, just...
So it's the auditing tools as much as security.
So it gives you a little insight on what the application is doing. And when you're running commercial applications that you don't have a source for, it's like, well, I want to first see what this thing does on my development box and say, I need to write a, if I need to confine it and I can't introvert it for some sort of reason, or I can't do other things I could potentially do, and this is just one way to say, what is this thing actually doing? So you can scrutinize it in that way, and you can protect, the sys trace.
Yeah, and then you can add parameters.
Then you can add parameters, maybe I don't want to do it.
And that chokes when it tries to build something you're not like.
And there's actually something, you can actually control the way the behavior of the program based on a deny, which, based on RNL, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You can, if you say, I want to deny this, but I want to tell the program why I denied it, I want to deny it because this file doesn't exist, or I want to deny it because permission denied. Or I want to give a...
It can recover.
Yeah, exactly. Or you can actually see why.
You can simulate different error conditions without having to actually change the permissions of a file or deleting it or renaming it or whatever. But that's a bit advanced, and that's why I didn't cover it, and I don't use it much.
Johnny is here.
Does
Fanny have the SP?
No. What would it be used for? I was thinking, in relation to second source, where we build up the software. I don't know how many other people, I don't know how many people actually read every line of code before they go ahead and build something.
Yeah.
So you could do something really simple, before you configure and build your software, you would put in a sys-trace policy on some shell process that execs everything that blocks the connect call, so you automatically prevent all call home type behavior from configuring or something like that. That doesn't sound like a too bad thing. That's an easy thing to do. That would be helpful to support.
Yeah.
That's actually that's actually what the OpenBSD ports do. There's a variable that you can set called use sys-trace. And it confines a source that's being built to its own unpacked directory. So it can execute the regular system binaries, sed, awk, whatever, and needed to build the program. But it can't write outside of it, and it does a lot of magic. But basically, it confines a port that's being built to its own directory. And there have been cases where software gets web servers get taken over, and then the binary is replaced with trojanized third-party source. And then people install it, and like when monkey.org got taken over, I think the dsniff binaries were replaced, and they were trojanized. So people started downloading them, and when you hit make install, it's game over, basically, because you have to do it as root. And then you self-rooted your own box. So, so these kinds of things would help out, because when you make install, you're only supposed to copy files into the home, into /user/local directory. You're supposed to, there's an expected behavior of installing, configuring software, and the OpenBSD ports do that already. It took a couple of months of work. Nicholas Sturm did that. You could probably look into that for package source and see if you can integrate that or something. That's pretty cool, I think. It helps when building third-party software. You don't know what you're building. When you're building a lot of software, and you don't have time to go through diffs from one version to another, and yeah. Helps me when I'm porting software or whatever. Ike?
The protocols you described are pretty sophisticated, but they're becoming more and more common. So this is pretty cool. But it seems like the way that works something a little more interactive, or something that you can catch running processes, you can modify in rule sets in the middle of processes. Is anybody going after this? Because it sounds to me kind of like the development of this feels like some patch filters. I don't know if that was a big patch filter waiting test in the room, but this sounds like some of the changes that came between IPF and Kia. system, rule-based system. You have sets of rules to edit, and then you have to put all this crazy, ridiculous interactivity and a much more focused, interactive user application. Is anybody moving in that direction? With
I don't understand how PF is interactive. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I guess we're talking. I guess I'm talking about something stupid because packets form you have an event, a packet comes in, modify the rule, the next packet comes in.
Oh, right.
So yeah, I guess you have a different technical base, but what I'm looking at is something that, or what I'm thinking about right now, is something that's in practice very similar processes, structured processes, for children.
So really dynamic updating of a rule set. Like Wes is talking about with his meeting at VSDCAN with integrating Snort and PF.
That's interesting. I mean, what if you change a comp file? You basically re-exec the file. I mean, SSH. You change S3 comp, you re-exec it and re-exec itself. So in essence, it would actually if you have that sys-trace. So in essence, if you're re-execing, you're re-execing.
Sure.
Sys-trace. I know that's interesting, because you could say the same thing about comp files, too, with running processes.
Sure. There are two things. If you use the GUI, the interactive GUI, you can actually, if you leave your policy open enough rule gets violated, and it will pop up the tool asking you if you want to permit or deny this call, sort of like the web browser example I used earlier. And that's sort of interactive in that it depends on the situation. It's not automated in that sense. But there's some level of, I don't want to call it interactive, but there's some sort of interactivity to it. And generally, it's static when you run it in certain environments that need it to be static. For example, daemons. Generally, they don't change very much. Their behavior is very static, and you don't really want to have them have some sort of way of updating the policy file. You want it to remain static. You want them to only read from this directory. You don't want them to be able to write any files or start connecting elsewhere, phoning home and stuff. I don't know. There's a reason to why it's not so interactive sometimes. And in practice, I think the simplicity is good enough, really. It deals with preventing getting a shell from any network connection, any network game or whatever. And I don't know, that's about it, I guess. Are you going to end up for a long time?
Yeah, one of the problems I run into with users who want certain web applications is I'm forced to put on some Perl script or some PHP program that's easily exploited. And in the past, it's been helpful if I can do something like you're not allowed to execute anything on TMP, which you can do through the file system, of course, or you're not allowed to say spawn a mass DOS attack against DNS with bin Perl, that sort of thing. So Perl would be a great example, I guess. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to make network connections except these things. Because that's happened a number of times where someone figures out how to make the Perl interpreter spawn some heinous network activity.
Yeah. And
most of the time Perl is just there to make a form work. It's not there to make
existing programs, basically it can do
a simple policy too, right?
Yeah.
Inet? No.
Yeah, basically. Or you don't even need to specify it if you run it in automatic policy enforcement mode. It just blocks it and logs it. Mm-hmm. So just don't
permitted, and you know, they block. Now that's the problem with, like, you know, running binaries. It's just that if it ever misbehaves, if there's a buffer overrun or something and it's caused by a malicious user, it can do whatever it wants. It can do what any other program in a file system can do. It can delete files, it can make connections, it can do for farms or whatever. And some of these, anyway, can be stopped by using sys-trace. Any other questions?
Because I was just saying, one of the things we could do is talk about what that online application should look like, maybe.
Uh-huh.
The online repository.
Oh.
Remember?
I don't know. I don't know how it would look like yet.
Oh, okay. So maybe it'd be a good place to do it. Okay. I'll show up.
So, in conclusion, Sanitizer seems, it's also open source, so you can port it to different areas if you want. If you have the expertise, I suppose, it's more of an expertise thing than anything, I guess. It has been, as I said, it has been ported to FreeBSD, it's been ported to Linux, and it's been ported to OS X. It's natively available for NetBSD and OpenBSD.
Don't run it on OS X, though, because I just installed it and I rebooted my... I will quote reboot.
What?
I just installed the package, the disk image package, and we'll reboot, so... It's the Mac package. And it goes...
Ray, is it in base?
Yes.
Yes. For NetBSD and OpenBSD. So, I'd like to thank Jen for staying up, actually, in the audience. Doug Song, George, Ike, Okan, you guys inspired and helped me with this. Neil Scopus for writing the software, obviously, even though he's kind of missing. If you'd like more information, you can go to systrace.org. There's, unfortunately, not too much information on systrace. People who use it a lot don't write too much about it. I'm trying to change that. There's a systrace shell, which is pretty cool. You can systrace people from the login shell and force them to use a systrace shell, prevent them from doing things you don't want them to do, or just protect yourself. This talk is available here at sys.net, Ray, sys-trace. Are there any more questions?
Good job.
If you hadn't gotten so drunk at Shmokan, you never would have done this.
I know.